Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
So it's my pleasure to again be here to introduce Philip, who did a panel just the other day. So Philip's the founder of the Embodied Present Process, author of Radical Wholeness and New Self, New World. He's a leader in the global embodiment movements, which he's been practicing for over 40 years and shares worldwide in workshops, facilitated trainings. Today, Philip's going to be talking to us about opening to your body's deeper intelligence. So how your body's processes are processes a billion times more information than you can be conscious of. So he's going to clarify the grounded nature of the body's intelligence and show you how you can use breath and meditation to provide a foundation of ease and grace to your life. So welcome, Philip.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you to everyone who has joined us today. that's a curious thing you mentioned, that the body processes a billion times more information than we can be conscious of. And we've put that part of us in charge of our lives. It's running on a billionth of the information that informs our lives, and on the basis of that takes charge. So that process of deepening into the body's intelligence, I mean, to me, it's really an essential part of both meditation and breath work. excuse me. I'd like to share the shape of this talk as I'd like to pursue it. There's a structure that I'd like to move through of nine questions, and I'll offer my response to those questions without any pretense of that response or those responses being definitive. It's just my take on it, but I'm hoping you might find that fruitful. And the purpose of the questions is just to open an inquiry into how meditation and breathwork can open us to that teeming, subtle, grounded, calm intelligence of the body. And I will, along the way, I'll share a couple of practices. And at the end, if you do have questions, it's my favorite thing to do is responding to questions. So there'll be as much time as I can allow for that at the end. So question number one of nine, it doesn't have an answer, but I still think it's a fruitful question to pose. What is the purpose of meditation? And of course, there's no such thing because there are so many different forms that meditation can take. And I remember, Robert Persig, who's the author of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, famously said, meditation doesn't have a purpose. If you're sitting with a purpose, it's not meditation. And, that has value, and I don't want to take anything away from that, but for me, you know, if there is a purpose to meditation, it is to attune to wholeness. And giving that answer creates something of a problem for us, because our whole culture has turned its back on wholeness. And if you have grown up in this culture, you will have had your neurology shaped by a disregard for wholeness. We talk about wholeness, we shop at Whole Foods, we love wholeness, but what we call wholeness is something else. We want wholeness to be contained in a boundary. So we speak, for instance, of wanting to be whole in body, mind, and spirit. And it's a beautiful sentiment. But look at what its subtext is. It's telling you that there are three parts to the self, and if you can allow each of those parts to flourish and come into relationship and harmony, you will be whole. The problem with that is it leaves the universe out of the equation. It's as though wholeness could be organized within yourself. All there is relationship. And to come into wholeness is to come into felt relationship with the world around you. So, you know, I would modify that at least to be whole in body, mind, spirit, and relationship. But I write about this in Radical Wholeness. I actually call our culture whole blind. And if you think about that, you know, we struggle to feel the self as a whole. And we no longer know what it means to speak from our wholeness or to listen from the whole of our being. What does it mean to think with the whole of your being? And even to feel the present as a whole is a struggle. I mean, you go on retreats for 10 days seeking to feel the present as a whole. And the irony is, all it is wholeness. There's no part of the present that isn't imbued in and manifesting of wholeness. That's all there is. So if you're not feeling the present as a whole, you're not feeling the present. And that brings us to question number two. If we have misunderstood the nature of wholeness, then what is the true nature of wholeness? Now, in answering that, just to be clear, it is impossible to know wholeness objectively. To begin with, wholeness isn't an object, so you can't know it objectively. Wholeness is an infinitely subtle, vast process in which every event affects every other event. But if you can't ever know the whole, understand that you can feel it. And that is our gift. The body's sensitivities can be attuned to its subtle currents. Our difficulty is we are trained like Pavlovian dogs to want to know, to want to grasp, to want to fix and sit down and have it here. And the nature of wholeness is such that that's a fruitless endeavor. So what can we say about wholeness? Wholeness doesn't have a boundary. Wholeness is undivided. It is unknowable. It excludes nothing. It includes everything. To feel wholeness is to feel reality. No part of reality is separate from it. The whole lives through its every part. So that sort of brings us to question number three. If all there is wholeness in the world, how do we lose our wholeness? It's kind of a trick question, because you can't lose your wholeness. I mean, how do you leave wholeness? Where would you go? All there is wholeness. You're held in every moment of your life in the embrace of the whole. And yet we don't feel it. So the issue isn't that we've lost wholeness. The issue is that we have desensitized ourselves to it. And that happens in our culture. It happens systematically. Any tension in the body that is held there is a form of resistance to the present, not wanting to feel some aspect of the whole. So our desensitivity to wholeness, it's not an intellectual impediment. It is an embodied thwarting. It is an embodied dullness that we have. And there's one thing that, you know, in our journey to wholeness, we need to understand, having desensitized to it, we have filled the body. If the body is full, then there's no room for the present to live through it and within it. Well, there's no room for it to be felt. So the body's full. We have, you know, shadows buried in our flesh. We hold ourselves within this boundary of me and fortify that boundary as though we were somehow separate from what is out there. And, you know, it's as though the world that holds us is of limited relevance to our lives. It's sort of the story of our culture in a way. And there's one primary cultural obsession that impairs our desire, our ability to feel wholeness, which is that we live in our heads. So that intelligence that is based in the head wants to know, and it is incapable of feeling. So you can, you know, you can operate on the brain and you don't need an anesthetic because it feels nothing. And the head, obsessive to know, overrides our ability to feel. You know, when you know everything that's around you, well, I know this is a desk and that's a window and that's a shelf. And there's nothing around me that I can't name. I know what everything is. Well, then why would I bother feeling any of it? What's the point? I know what it is. So we dull our bodies with this emphasis on knowing. And the head, you know, has this obsession with organizing. And I think our obsession to organize is the obsession that drives our culture. And there's nothing we don't organize. I mean, we organize our emotions. We organize our thoughts. We organize our relationships. We organize our agendas. We organize our responses. I mean, you know how that happens. Somebody, you know, a friend, you see a friend crossing the street and you organize your response to them before your being has had a chance to feel their presence. Now, organizing is necessary. We wouldn't all be here today for this presentation if we hadn't been organized. It's not to deny the value of organizing, but when organizing becomes an obsession, it's impossible to be present, because the quality of presence, for me anyway, is the quality of feeling yourself being organized by the present. If we have taken charge of the self and we're so busy organizing ourselves, the present has no chance to be felt in its subtle informing of every part of our being. So I think one of the main benefits of both meditation and breath work is that they provide some relief from that obsession of needing to get it right, of needing to organize. And that brings us to question number 4. If we're missing wholeness in our lives, how can we achieve it? Again, it's a bit of a trick question, because you can't achieve wholeness. It's already there. It's all there is. What's there to achieve? But what's necessary isn't to achieve it. You know, we have to undo that imperative of doing that drives us to get it right. What's needed, what's being asked of us, is that we surrender to it. And that surrendering, we're just surrendering to what is. How do we do that? How do we undo the body that it can once again resensitize to the currents wafting through it? That process of surrendering is illuminated by the hero's journey. And Joseph Campbell wrote beautifully about the hero and the tyrant. And he characterized the hero as the man of self-achieved submission. For me, what that means is you submit to what is with a willingness to feel it and be activated by it. The world is whispering to you at every moment to come and put your gifts into service. You've been born with a unique cluster of gifts that no one else in the world has ever had. And the world needs those gifts. And it is calling to you to activate them, to put them into service. So you can't achieve wholeness. And in that way, it's unlike almost every other ideal that you could take for your life, guide your life by. You know, there are ideals like courage and loving kindness and truthfulness, and they're wonderful. But each of them carries a little risk, because, you know, say you take the ideal of compassion. I want to be compassionate, which is beautiful, and I have nothing against that. But here's the risk: you go into a situation and you remember, oh yes, I should be compassionate here. Well, now you risk division, because there's a part of you that knows exactly what compassion looks like, knows how it sounds, knows how it feels, and brings the rest of you along to achieve it. So you are out of wholeness, you are in division. The part of you that knows, the part of you that's being brought along. Wholeness is different. You can't achieve it, you just surrender to it. Now, what I've noticed is that with that surrender to wholeness, all those other ideals towards which we strive just seem to fall into place. I mean, how could I be in wholeness and not feel compassion? How could I be in wholeness and say something I knew not to be true? If I'm in wholeness, I have the courage to follow what I'm being called to. So wholeness, for me anyway, leads to all those other human values that we cherish, but it does so without threatening to pull us into division. So if surrender is the only way to rejoin wholeness, what is the nature of surrender? What's the nature of that self-achieved submission that Joseph Campbell talked about? And it's important. It's an important question, because for me, again, breath work and embodied meditation are about that self-achieved surrender. So if you are surrendering to wholeness, it seems to me there is only one way of doing that, and that is with a process of integration. Integration means to make whole. So the surrender to wholeness is a process of self-achieved integration. You cannot arrive at wholeness by trying to transcend or fix or overcome or get rid of. That's not wholeness. Wholeness excludes nothing. Wholeness includes everything. So what we're looking at is how to integrate, how to bring together these shattered parts of self and world so that once again they come into relationship. And because our resistance to wholeness is held in the flesh, that integration is an embodied process. So that brings us to question number 6. What part does the body play in integration, in that surrender? You know, we rely on the intelligence of the head habitually, we're taught to, but we're blind almost to its limitations. It knows brilliantly how to pull things to pieces, how to analyze, how to systemize, but it knows nothing about integration. It knows nothing of wholeness. It can't feel wholeness. So integration happens through the body's intelligence. You know, reason, the limitations of reason, you think about it. What do you most cherish in your life? The things of most value for me anyway are to be present. I can't reason my way into the, I could sit here all day and try to reason my way into the present and it just wouldn't work. You know, love, you can't reason your way into love. You can't reason your way into the self-achieved submission. It's a physical process that plays out through you. So, the body is what enables us to integrate. The body's intelligence is what enables us to integrate. And that, in, you know, that integration, it's an integration of the psyche. It's an integration of the mind. But again, let's not confuse the mind with the brain. I mean, the brain is a part of our mind for sure, but the brain in the head is not the mind. You know the world through the body. I mean, if I look at this glass across the room, I know what it is. Why do I know what it is? Because I picked it up, because I've drunk from it, because I've held it and felt its texture and its cool. My body knows what it is. It's through the body I come to know the world around me. So mind is meaningless without the body. And I would go even further. I would say there is an equivalence between the mind and the body's energy. And think about that. When you've just had a massage and your body is so calm and your mind is calm. Or, you know, you're off to a high tension meeting or whatever, and your body's energy is jittery and your mind is jittery. The state of one is the state of the other. There is an equivalence between these. So to feel the body's energy is to be able to integrate the body's intelligence and bring it into coherence. And our difficulty in approaching that is similar to, if you think of the solar system, our planetary system, and then imagine the sun disappears. And what happens to the planets? They suddenly careen off into outer space. So all that would be left of that system is its parts. There's an analogy there, because we have lost the center that orients our wholeness. Our lives are fragmented. The parts of our lives have drifted. They've come out of relationship. And the center that we have lost most fundamentally is our relationship with the earth. We don't know what it is to rest on the earth in our culture. Our energy is up high in the body. It's not down. It's not at rest on the earth. We don't feel the teeming life of the earth beneath our feet. You know, human, the word human is etymologically related to the word humus, earth. Human beings are earth beings. And I don't think it's possible to be at rest in the present if you're not at rest on the earth. Again, I think there's an equivalence between those. But we've turned our center not into the earth, but into the head. So it's like the old solar system, the Ptolemaic solar system that placed the earth at the center. And then it's trying to make sense of the movement of the planets. And the planets are doing loop the loop, just, you know, it doesn't make any sense. So we sit in our heads trying to make sense of the world, and it's nonsense. It's not until we drop down into the body and recover that sense of being at rest on the earth that suddenly there's a lucidity to the world around us. It comes into coherence. So that dissociation from the earth, that leaving of our center, is an old, old story. I mean, it feels modern, but it's 8,000 years old in the making. It began with the Neolithic Revolution, where we discovered agriculture and domesticated animals and built permanent settlements and started to take control of the earth. And as that happened, as our survival became increasingly dependent on control, there are four changes, really significant cultural changes, that we went through simultaneously. One is we turned from the mother, whom we were gathered around, to the father. So, you know, Paleolithic, early Neolithic cultures were matrifocal. They were gathered around the mother. And then suddenly we drifted into patriarchy. The second change is that we turned from the goddess to the god. So suddenly from the female incarnation of being to the male power. We also turned from the earth to the sky. So, you know, the really, really interesting prayers from ancient Mesopotamia, and their early, early prayers to Nidaba, the goddess, who is manifest in the grasses. She can be heard in the brooks. She is imminent in all things of nature. And sometime later, you can see how the allegiance has shifted to Enlil, who is scheming and clever and can control anything. So what happened, the fourth change that this all reflects, is that our center of awareness moved from the belly up through the body. It migrated and ended up in the head. So it left the belly center, which I feel as the female pole of my consciousness. And it moved increasingly into the abstractions of the head. And, you know, you can trace that journey in language, in art, in, you see it in Homer. Homer, around 800 BC, talks about phrein or phrenos, which means mind. It also means diaphragm. And there's one translator who preserves the sense of that, Richmond Lattimore. He'll say once in a while, the mind within my breast understands your words. But we have sort of forgotten that journey. You know, we consider the brain to be the ultimate thinker. The body doesn't think, it's a vehicle. That shows up in Plato. That's 350 BC. Plato's already writing about the body as a vehicle and the head as the sort of deified part of ourselves. So that brings us to question number 7. If we've lost our center, how does that show up? And it shows up in really, really tangible ways. So there, one thing I'd like to go into, there is a landscape to human intelligence. And that landscape has been shattered. And let me try to put some context on that. So there is intelligence in the head, and there is intelligence in the heart. And we treat those centers of intelligence in an either-or fashion. So I can be analytical, or I can feel from the heart, but they don't go together. How would they go together? So we're flipping back and forth between this binary polarity. Or, you know, there's an intelligence in the legs. The legs teem with intelligence. They know the world in ways that you couldn't imagine if you haven't felt it. And that's out of relationship with the thinking of the head. And the hands know the world so intimately. But we do with the hands. The hands become out of touch with our gut, with our being, with our sense of relationship. And we just do on the world without feeling it as we do it. So we're like those planets, if the sun disappeared, that come out of relationship and sail off, you know, on their own. So meditation or breath work, you know, if they're about attuning to relationship, I think it's crucial to recognize how the landscape of our intelligence has been shattered. And then, you know, question number 8, what is the geography of the body's intelligence, helps us understand that landscape. Because the body's intelligence isn't homogeneous. There are landmarks in it. There is subtlety in it. And I'd like to talk about some of the more prominent landmarks. I can't possibly do justice to the subtlety of it here. But for instance, the head is like a lighthouse. You sit up in the head and you're at a distance from the world and you gain perspective. And that perspective is crucially valuable. Perspective is wonderful. But a perspective that isn't integrated is a perspective that will impede your ability to feel the world. Like, I know that's a tree out the window. I know that's a light. I know this is the sunlight coming in through the window. But if I know it without integrating it, I don't feel it. The pelvic bowl, for me, is the center of my being. From the pelvic bowl, from that ancient intelligence, I come into felt relationship with the world around me. Within the pelvic bowl, the pelvic floor is the ground of my being. It's to the pelvic floor I return when I come home to myself. It's on the pelvic floor I land when I want to abide in my deepest truth. Within the pelvic floor, there is the perineum at the very center of the pelvic floor. And the perineum, in my experience, is the still point from which everything can be felt, from which we connect to wholeness. Now, if the pelvic floor is the ground of your being, that might seem to leave out of the equation the legs. But the legs are the roots of your being. The legs connect you to the earth, to the center on which you rest. They locate you here and now. And there's the heart. Our culture pays a lot of attention to the heart, and we in general, we're trying to go from the head to the heart. And I think that's a mistake. I think if the heart isn't connected with your being, it can't express your being. And if the heart's not expressing your being, what is it expressing? You know, the heart can remain subservient to the head. You go into a room and you meet someone and you say, oh yes, I should open my heart here. But the, you know, if that cradle of the pelvic bowl is the cradle of our being, it's like the earth, and there is this flower stem rising from the roots in that earth, and the heart is a flower, and it is nourished by your being and supported by your being, and we are asking things of our hearts that we're not supporting them in. I think the heart is the portal through which my wholeness meets the wholeness of the world. If I'm not in my wholeness, how can I access that portal? And then the breath. The breath is the energy that brings unity to that landscape of your being. And with your permission, I'd love to bring some flesh to these ideas. I'd love to share a practice with you. A practice that involves breath and involves the intelligence of the legs. And we can just play with it for a minute. You know, if your body needs to move, let it move, let it settle, let it express. And let's begin with the breath. I'd like to say, I don't buy that there is a right way to breathe. I just don't. I mean, every breath is a response to the present, and the present is always new. And how can you say there's a right way to breathe? But to me, there's an abiding principle. And that principle says that the whole of your body can be available to the breath. And so let's explore that. We're used to breathing in a top-down manner where, oh, it's important to breathe deeply, and we push the breath down into the body, and that takes muscular effort. The muscles get tired, the breath goes shallow again. That's not how a baby breathes. A baby releases its body to the breath. So gently, gently bring your awareness to the body's energy. And be aware that your body is 65% water. You are a fluid being. And as you allow your awareness to settle on the breath, you'll feel the breath as a wave moving through the fluidity of your body. And the wave just doesn't move through the body's fluidity. The wave gathers what has been rendered consolidated and eases it into fluidity. So bring your awareness as deep as you can within the body, down, if you can, to the pelvic floor. And at the end of the out-breath, maybe just for fun, exaggerate the out-breath a little bit and then let go. You just let go of the body and it releases to the in-breath. And as it releases to the in-breath, you feel the breath rippling through the body's fluidity. So there's a breath wave that travels up through the body to the top of the head. And just see if you can feel it. And if you can't feel it, imagine it, because imagination is right in touch with our body's neurology. It informs it. So just by imagining that breath wave, you're on your way to feeling it. And then feel that breath wave travel down through the arms to the fingertips. And it's a subtle thing. We're not looking for something gross or dramatic, it's subtle. And to allow your awareness to drop to that level of subtlety is to open the door to your own life. And then feel that breath wave moving down through the legs. So it may just move through the thighs to begin with, or into the thighs, and that's okay. And if you don't feel it, just let yourself imagine it, because it feels good to imagine it. Breath wave travels down through your thighs. You may feel it traveling down through the calves to the soles of your feet. And wherever the body is consolidated, wherever it's locked up against the present, allow the breath wave to be an expression of love. And that love gathers the body and holds it in its embrace and softens it. And finally, that breath wave is traveling through the whole of your being. So the whole of your body is available to the breath. And as you begin to soften into the legs, as they come back into their natural fluidity, see if you can gently allow your awareness to drop down into the legs and allow them to show you what they know. So in all humility, allow the breath to flow through the legs. Allow your awareness to follow that love. Allow the legs to show you what they know at this moment. That is the surrender. And at the same time, that is the process of integration. Encouraging back into sensitivity what has been lost. Encouraging back into wholeness what has been divided. And once again, just for a moment, feel the breath wave coursing through the whole of your being, the top of your head, to your fingertips, and surrender to all that comes up for you. Let it carry you someplace. You're not in charge of getting it right or of taking it someplace. And as you release the body to the breath, you may discover that at the same time, you are releasing the body to the present. You release the body to the in-breath. You release the body to the out-breath. And you feel the body's energy coming into coherence. So that brings this practice to a close. I still have one more question I'd like to talk about. What steps enable us to attune to the whole through the body? This is a process that doesn't end. It's not that you do it and it's done. It's not that you wake up one day and say, oh, finally I'm whole, what next? It's the surrender doesn't end. The surrender is your life. It's your dance with the partnership of the present. But it's helpful to look at what makes that possible. And the first stage is bringing the fractured landscape of the body's intelligence back into unity, to feel the shadows and welcome them with love, to bring them to the center of your being and invite them to integrate. And the process of integration for me, what is unintegrated has been kept from our being. We can't afford, for whatever reason, to feel it. And the years go by and we ground ourselves and discover our strength. And the time comes when you can afford to bring that energy back in contact with your being. You can allow it to integrate and find its place. And as you, that takes us to step two, because as those shadows and compartmentalizations are integrated, the body comes into unity. And that unity is not a state of fullness. It's a state of emptiness. Being is spacious. The present is spacious. And in that state of unity, you recover and experience within you the spaciousness of the present. So it's no longer that the present is out there. The present is alive within the spaciousness of your being. That's where it's felt. And that brings us to step number three, is as you begin to attune to the present through the body, the present becomes more interesting than your ideas about it. And that's kind of a strange revelation, because we're so busy organizing our ideas and getting them right. We spend so many hours of our day thinking about our own thoughts about the present and not feeling the present. And suddenly here is this companionship, this living present that you can feel in its wholeness and that never goes away. And why would you ever again fall into the self-consciousness that takes the spotlight of your attention off the world and puts it onto yourself and locks you in that prison of supervision of the self and judgment and the need to somehow get it right, whatever it is. So I'd love to, in the time left, turn to some questions. I just want to say in closing that the essential nature of the body is that of a bell. When the bell is full, it doesn't ring. To integrate those tensions, those shadows, those consolidations of the body is to recover once again the spaciousness. And your body's intelligence will ring to the present and quicken you to it. And you will come into a communion that never goes away. Our word consciousness, where we want to be conscious, we want to raise our consciousness. Our word consciousness, etymologically, means to be mutually aware. And when you enter into a mutual awareness of the present, then you have truly opened to your body's deeper intelligence. So I'm gonna click on the Q&A and see. Does embodiment, Deborah, does embodiment exist on a spectrum, or is it an all or nothing thing? I'm thinking spectrum. And if so, can you speak to the levels of it? Yeah, I agree. Spectrum. In my first book, New Self, New World, I talk about the levels specifically. There are nine levels that I talk about, where from a lack of embodiment to a porosity. You know, when you're fully embodied, no one is in charge. That's my experience. In the same way that in an ant colony, no ant is in charge. No ant ever gives another ant an instruction. In a school of fish, in a murmuration of starlings,
No one is in charge. There is this congruent harmony, not just within the body, but between the body and the world, and the dance goes on and the creativity flourishes, but no one's in charge. So I'd invite you to maybe, if you can find a copy of New Self, New World, you might find those 9 stages interesting. In your view, from Cheryl, what creates the safety to let go of trying to control what is not ours to control? Gosh, that's a great question. To let natural processes, environments, conditions be. Cheryl, there is a dance between surrender and security. The most fundamental security you have is the security of your being. And to me, that is down in the pelvic bowl to bring awareness back to that gently. But you can't just surrender. You can't just let go. You let go a little bit into the body and you find a little more security. And that security enables another little release that brings you another moiety of security. And so it goes. It's the surrender, the security, the surrender, the security. It's this dance in which each supports the other. Madeline, would you say that having to stick to a particular meditation or breathwork technique keeps us in striving for achievement? You know, if it works for you, wonderful. It's not my practice. I go into the unknown to discover. And every journey is its own journey. I'm not the same twice, and I don't feel I should be. I'm not trying to get myself to a certain place. I'm trying to surrender to wholeness. And when I surrender to wholeness, every time that happens, I'm taken someplace new. It has never been here before. It will never be again. Wholeness is an evolution. And to surrender to wholeness is to be bathed in its newness. So that's my approach. I wouldn't take anything away from a structure that supports you in your exploration. Livia, lately it feels that trying to give an answer to who I truly am is what creates problems with integration. When I connect to the feel that I am nothing, yet then it feels like something falls off, and only then can I become all and feel whole and connected. Listen, we have a choice in life. You can be who you know yourself to be, or you can be present. It's one or the other. If you have a structure, this is my identity, this is who I am, you're going to have to defend that structure. And that takes energy and wears us out. You discover who you are as you surrender to the present. You stand before a tree and you feel its presence and you are illuminated by that tree. You look at a little child playing on the sidewalk and you feel her presence and you are illuminated by that. The more deeply you come into felt relationship with the world, the more deeply you discover who you are as a process, as an unfolding, not as a static concept. Static concepts are artifices that need a huge amount of fortification and defense. How are we for time?
Yeah, we're pretty much going to move to wrap up here. Yeah, it's a lovely way to finish that off. Right, okay, so I'm going to throw over to you again, Philip. You're getting a few chances to do this, but share us top tip for living in a more embodied life. But first, I'd like to share where people can find out a little bit more about you. So you've got a special link for us on the conference, which I posted at the start as well, which is at the embodied presence that you've created for us. And we've also, would you like to throw anyone anywhere else or?
Well, Yeah, I'd just like to say I'm putting into the chat room now a link to the 9 questions that my talk was shaped around. So if that's useful to you, just go to that link. They're there. You can copy them, whatever. It's available. What would I leave people with? The head, the knowing of the head, the thinking of the head, wants to come into known relationship with everything. And the pelvic bowl, and it's not a matter of being aware of the pelvic bowl from the head. It's how can you reverse that 8,000-year-old journey and drop the awareness down through your body to rest in the pelvic bowl so that you are aware of the world from there. You feel it from there. And what that intelligence, what that pole of my consciousness yearns for is to come into felt relationship. And so to notice the tension between known relationship and felt relationship within your daily life. And what will facilitate felt relationship for me is always the quality of gentleness. As you feel the breath as gently as you can, you come into relationship with it in a new way. As you feel the presence of another being as gently as you can, you come into felt relationship. How to be gentle with yourself, with the world, is the most direct way I know of to bring your life back into that realm of living felt relationship.
Thank you, and a lot of love coming through in the chat, and thank you, Stuart, as well. So just to close this out, Philip's been a big supporter of the conference. If any of you guys would like to help out and grab the library to digest in your own time as well, you can upgrade. There's various packages there available. And we appreciate it as a thank you to us, and it enables everyone else to view it for free if you sort of can afford it yourself, and it's well worth it to integrate it. I'd also say that you can sort of go back and integrate in the coffee rooms now. There are nice things to chat with other people about what Philip's just talked to us about. So do check out his 9 questions. Do check out the website and everything that he's led us through today. Have a little chat. Go to the Facebook group. And we've got Dan Brulé up next. Another master. It's a wonderful night tonight. Or morning, or wherever you are, I'm not quite sure. So thank you, Philip. And Philip will be joining us again. Sorry, you want to say something there?
I was just going to say that link, you know, if you don't find it in the chat, it's just embodiedpresent.com/questions. Embodiedpresent.com/questions. Oh, sorry. Thank you, Steve.
Perfect. And I'll just say as well that I believe you will be joining us still on October 19 at 8 p.m. UK time, what embodiment means to me. Also doing a panel on the final day at 8 p.m. and another panel on October 20 at 2 a.m. all in UK time. But so there's 3 more sessions Philip is on as well. So you can get your...
I'm looking forward to every one of them.
Cheers, and thanks everyone, and thank you again, Philip.
Thank you all.